Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Tom Gimbel in Fast Company a few years back wrote a piece that began this way. About 3 years ago, my company tried an experiment. We declared a no email day for an entire weekday. The whole office powered down our inboxes completely. We didn't just turn off alerts and notifications. We set all out-of-office auto responses and went cold turkey. It was such a success that we're still doing it once a quarter. Wow. Tom, I know you wrote that a few years ago, Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Are you guys still doing something like that?
Yeah, we started it up again during COVID. Since everything was remote all the time, it was almost impossible to do that. So for the past 3 years, we haven't. I think I wrote that in 2017 or 2018.
Yeah.
And so we were doing it then between once a quarter and once every 6 months. And now this will be the first time we've done it post-pandemic. So I'm really excited about it. I think that, the basics haven't changed. That is, you send a text or an email and people misunderstand what capitalizations mean and what an exclamation point means, God forbid three exclamation points, and people misunderstand. And my goal is that I think that people step out of their shell, they need to be pushed and to pick up the phone and really have strong dialogue with people, not 50 back and forth messages or emails.
Your staff like it?
I think probably 70 to 75% like it. I'd be ignorant and naive and arrogant probably to think everybody does, but I think well over half are excited about it.
Now we're down to 55%. I just wonder what percent, because it's, what do you do then when you don't have email, Tom?
There are codicils, right, John? So if you're sending something that needs an attachment, you can send an email. So if it's a bill, if it's an invoice, we're in the recruiting business, if it's a resume, you can send it. But you can't just email somebody out of the blue and say, hey, are you free? You got to pick up the phone and you got to call people.
Yeah.
And so the goal is that you have a whole list of to-dos that you're working on, and you're either doing stuff on Excel or Word or PowerPoint or what have you, or you're calling up somebody to talk about it.
I wonder if the reason I just kind of teased you about maybe the staff not being crazy about it is because I don't know that our verbal skills are as finely tuned as they used to be or as maybe sharp, we think, as our written skills on texting or email.
Well, I think there's probably something to that, but we even do it internally. So we use Teams, some other companies use Slack or what have you, that you can't use that for internal communication. So yeah, if you're in another office, you got to pick up the phone. And if you're in the same office, you got to get off your butt and walk over and talk to somebody. And I do believe that from both fear of rejection to laziness, society in the workplace has gotten very reliant on email versus phone. And I just believe that the best relationships you make are the ones you meet face to face. And when it reverts to text, you lose something.
Talk about fear of rejection and why we sort of hide behind the email then.
Well, I think number one, I'll just give a free plug to a book called Rejection Proof. And to you and or any of your listeners, I think it's a great read from a guy that spent a long time teaching himself to not be afraid of rejection. And I think that when you pick up a phone, the first thing somebody usually says in the work environment is, you know, hey, John, are you busy right now? Hey, John, is it a good time to talk? Right? You're expecting somebody to not be available for you. And that's a mindset issue. Instead of realizing your time is valuable, their time is valuable, what you want to talk about has importance, and that's why I'm calling.
That's funny because I do that with my family, let alone colleagues. I'll text and say, is this a good time to chat? You would recommend that I just call them flat out?
Yeah, you call up your son or your daughter or your wife, and you go, you know, hey, Mary, what's going on? How are you? Hey, want to ask you a question? Like when you say, it's now a good time, you're opening up the ability for somebody to say, no, it's not, and that's not business, right? When you walk into a retail store and somebody says, can I help you? It's easy for everybody instinctively to say, no, thanks, just looking. But if you walked up to somebody and you said, oh, are you looking for a blout for a shirt or pants? Right? Now, all of a sudden, you're taking it down a different path. And it's the same thing on the phone. Vendor, client, internal person. You call up and you say, hey, Bob, good to talk to you. Got a quick question I want to ask you.
And I guess it's incumbent upon that person, if it really is a bad time or if they can't talk, then they're an adult. They can say, hey, it's great to hear from you, Tom. Listen, I'm going to call you back in a half an hour. I'm busy, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the key is, and it's more of a sales mentality, but we should do it in any line of business that we are, is that if you give somebody an opportunity to say no to something they're not familiar with, they're usually going to take it.
Yeah.
But if you don't give them an opportunity, the idea of doing something different is actually appealing. And once they're engaged in the conversation, it's a positive thing. An email gets deleted with the click of a button. A phone call, you actually have to be rude and hang up on somebody.
Tom Gimbel, text him today or email him today because he's not going to be available on email tomorrow. Tomorrow is Wednesday, and that'll be no email day where they shut down their email and instant messaging. It's an intriguing idea, Tom. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Absolutely, John. I'm heading on vacation. I won't talk to you for a couple weeks.
Well, we'll miss you. Have a great vacation and come back tan, rested, and ready. He's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Philip Weiss joins us, President Seifarth at Work. I think, listen, Philip, you've always got intriguing ideas and the examples to back it up, but I think this is going to be a tough sell today. You know that?
Well, I'm ready to try to do my best, my yeoman's effort to promote the idea.
When getting sued turns out to be a good thing. What are you talking about?
Yeah, and, you know, to your intro, John, it is somewhat counterintuitive because we all know and we've all seen if we watch any TV shows tracking legal cases that lawsuits are a torturous process, whether it's the deposition, being grilled on the stand as a defendant, or, worst of all, facing a big payout. It is a painful process for many companies and managers who are defendants. But we've heard from a number of clients in the last few months that there can be a silver lining. And admittedly, this does not apply when you're raked across the coals of the headlines or the judgment is so steep you're paying hundreds of millions of dollars. But if there are cases out there that our clients have seen that actually have produced a benefit, it's those where they had to pay something. They had to change some practices. But as a result, they took a hard look at their internal protocols, the way they engage people, and they made other improvements. So being forced to take a hard look at the company, at itself in the mirror, proved to be a positive.
That's interesting because I think when we hear about a lot of these kinds of cases, we wonder if being punitive is actually being corrective. If they'll pay the fine, okay, fine, but they are still the people they were before they had to. You think sometimes this actually makes people change or the company cultures change?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the key word there is sometimes. And again, it really depends on the nature of the lawsuit. If it was incredibly acrimonious and full of diatribes flying back and forth, it may be hard for the company to focus anything but on the result of the lawsuit. But in many cases, there's more than meets the eye. We actually worked with a company. It's a chain of bars in the Southwest, and they were sued because they had historically only hired female waitstaff, and they ended up settling the case, hiring more diverse waiters and waitresses from all different backgrounds. But then they took a moment and said, you know, is there anything else we can do to make our business better, safer, more welcoming? And they actually changed their decor, which was a pretty gory, ghoulish, horror movie theme. They changed some of their hiring practices for their bouncers at the front because these were some burly-looking guys that were actually intimidating potential customers. So they ended up increasing sales by looking at how they handled other areas of their operation. And that is not a unique situation. And the company looked back at it and said, you know what, we didn't want the lawsuit, but we benefited from the follow-up changes.
This is a tangent to that, but you made me think about that. Hooters, the bar and restaurant, famously has pretty girls and of a certain type. And I've often wondered, do they not hire any guys on the waitstaff? Can they do that? And can they discriminate against what they feel are women that look the type and women that don't? Do you know how they're able to do that or what happens there?
Right. Well, I can't speak to specifics, meaning a company per se, but I will tell you what companies do when they're sued is they'll say, look, this is our identity. It is our business. It is sort of the DNA of what allows us to sell to our customers. So that's one defense. It has worked. It also has not always worked. There are other situations where companies can say, look, we're putting on a production. In a way, we are almost like an entertainment venue, and
right. There's
a casting element to what we're doing. Mm. So there's a number of ways you can play it in court. But frankly, in many situations, you're somewhat rolling the dice when you only hire certain people for certain roles. I mean, obviously, you know, if you got a men's room attendant at a hotel, historically, you can argue, I'm going to have a male attendant there. We know that. That actually is no longer the kind of thing you worry about because times have changed, which really is sort of a symbol of where we are. The more diversity in terms of at least including applicants, the better.
So you worked with a Chicago company in a different arena. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is fascinating. This is a big transport company, and they had a pretty large lawsuit, and part of the requirement of the settlement was they have to educate their managers on not making stereotypical comments regarding certain groups of employees. And frankly, John, they could have gotten away with just putting a paragraph in their team meetings, we don't want you doing this, we want you to understand how important it is not to make these comments. But some really sharp, savvy compliance leaders, like one level below the executive team, said, we have already this requirement. Let's now launch four-hour training on every aspect of management. Let's make it fully interactive, very comprehensive, and let's include this requirement and say, hey, we're meeting a requirement, and we've already got people in the room. Let's teach them how to be great managers. The results were really dramatic in terms of enhance consistency of supervision. So that's a great example where you have one requirement and you snowball it because it's sitting there and it gives you a door opener.
We got to go, but I suppose it would be nice if companies were proactive. They didn't wait until they got sued to do these things.
Yeah, and the key there, John, is don't just look in the mirror. Look at your industry. There are enough other companies
yeah.
who are getting hit
yeah.
by this kind of claim that might affect you. So you can learn from others before you have to learn from your own experience.
Yeah, let the other guy get sued. It's fascinating stuff, as always, from Philip Weiss, the president of Seyfarth at Work, Seyfarth, Seyfarth at Work. Philip, we'll talk again soon. Thank you, sir. Bob Bertog is going to join us tomorrow, our resident landscaping and lawn expert. He talks to us about how to get rid of weeds and things like that. We never talked to him, though, about the tools themselves that you might use in your yard and which ones are the best and which ones are different. Mark Hicks is going to help us out now, regional sales manager at Northern Tool on that topic. They've got stores throughout the area. Hey, Mark, this is John. You're on the air. How are you?
John, I'm doing well today, sir. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good. I said stores throughout the area. How many stores you got in Chicagoland? What is your footprint around here?
Right now, John, we have three stores. We opened our first store back in 2021 in Mount Prospect, so that's our oldest store. We are now operating in Melrose Park, and we have our newest location in Glendale Heights.
So what do you sell?
The future store.
Is it retail for homeowners or is it more on the industrial side?
John, we serve both the DIYer and the professional. So you can walk into a Northern Tool and be able to find the right product of what you're looking for your skill set. And like I said, you know, we deal with folks that's just wanting to take care of a few things at the house and work outside. And also that person that's out there, you know, doing industrial work.
Well, my skill set includes pushing a mower. I can do that. But my neighbor has an electric mower, and I have a gas-powered mower. What do you think? Which one should somebody have?
You know, John, from that standpoint, it is all going to fall down to personal choice and what you're going to be using it for. You know, if you're looking for something you can just grab and go, and it's a small project that you want to do, and you want to knock it out and get it out of the way, having an electric mower is definitely a convenience from that standpoint. And with innovation and constantly changing battery types that allow you to do larger products. You know, you can go anywhere from a quarter acre now up to, you know, well over an acre with an electric device, and also get that in a zero turn more so.
I was thinking about that because there were electric mowers that had a cord, right? But now it's all battery powered, and those would do a quarter acre of lawn, say, if you can expect that these days?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, at a minimum, that you'd be out there and do it with. You know, we carry the Ego brand and Northern Tool and Equipment. It's an excellent product. We also carry a Milwaukee electric mower that, honestly, you would think the moment that you put your hands on it, you were pushing a gas-powered unit.
Because it's that powerful?
Because it's that powerful. And, you know, it runs on Milwaukee's M18 battery, so the batteries are interchangeable with all the other products that they make, whether you're using a trimmer, a hedger, or, you know, a cordless drill. The same battery would work in that product.
On my gas-powered mower, though, I just have a compartment for oil to change, and I've never changed it. I don't know how to change the oil on a lawnmower. Is that something I got to take into a place, or do I just pour some more in there?
No, you definitely want to take and get that. When you bring that mower out of the garage or the shed for this new season, you definitely want to make sure that you've got a new air filter on it and you've changed that, and that you've also changed the oil. And at Northern Tool and Equipment, Mount Prospect, we actually have a service department there that would be more than happy to be able to give your lawn equipment a tune-up for you.
Don't laugh at me, Mark. I'm very sensitive about these sorts of things. So should I get my lawnmower blades sharpened? Because I've never done that before either.
You know, absolutely. And that's one of the things, John, that people really never consider when they're bringing their equipment out. You know, is once you've checked your fuel, your oil, changed the filters, you know, the next best thing to have done is getting the blade sharpened. Because without a sharp blade, you're basically out there tearing the top off the grass, which is going to leave the brown spots and ragged edges. You're just not going to be happy with how that lawn looks.
I don't know if people care this much about that, but tell me what you think about this. I've heard that if it's gas versus electric tools, edgers or mowers or whatever, the gas-powered ones are very inefficient. They put off a lot of pollution. Electric ones obviously don't. Is that still the case?
Well, you will find now, from a gas standpoint, you're still going to have carbon emissions from that. But your electric tools are definitely a cleaner form of energy to use. You know, from a standpoint of that gasoline engine, not a lot has changed over that in the last 5 years. So they're more fuel efficient. They put out less emissions now. But if you're looking for a clean way to go out and operate out in the yard, electric's definitely what you'd want to look at this point.
But I worry that, see, at least for the gas-powered one, man, I can rev that thing. Or at least it does seem to have a higher, it seems to be turning faster or stronger. My neighbor, sometimes he runs into thick grass. I'm thinking, dude, you're not going to get through that. You should have a gas-powered mower.
You know, when you look at it today with the offerings that we have out there from a standpoint of electric, there is zero difference between, you know, being able to get through that grass, whether it's, you know, knee high or whether it's 6 inches and you're just taking the top two off. You'll get the same performance, same torque, same spin off that blade that you get from a gasoline engine.
If you were starting from scratch, and so now you got your mower, and you got edges and bushes and lawn and stuff like that, the things folks usually have, what would be the next tool you would get to have a nice-looking exterior of your home?
You know, probably something that would let me do a great – you're definitely going to need a wheelbarrow for mulching, because you always want to make sure that that's done and so forth. But I tell you what really makes the difference is having a great edger that you can go through and cut an edge between the lawn and the flower bed to just give it a great look.
I love my edger. I'm trying to remember the name on it. Did you say you guys have Echo? Is that one of the brands you carry?
Ego is the brand that we carry from an electric standpoint. From a gasoline standpoint, we have some really great brands out there, from Power Horse to Clutch and Ironton, that, you know, are Northern Tool brands. Awesome equipment. And then a Milwaukee powered equipment, if you're looking for that from an edger standpoint.
And I'm just going along. I've done it three times already. The neighbors are like, would you stop it already? But when stuff starts to fill in that gap, I want a real clean line. So I just kind of walk it. I'm walking it backwards. Am I doing that right?
Yes, sir. You absolutely are. You got to be able to walk it that way, and then make sure that you've got the guard, you know, facing down to where you're not going to get anything thrown back up at you. But yes, sir, absolutely walking backwards with it.
Yeah. Every now and then I get sparks because I scrape it a little close, but I guess that's just the nature of the beast, right?
Yes, sir, absolutely.
Four-cycle engines, and what's the other kind of engine on these machines? Two-cycle? Is that? Can you talk to me about the difference, and should I be cognizant of that if I'm buying?
You know, in a two-cycle engine, John, at that point, you are going to be doing a ratio of gas and oil into that, and it's a special oil that's sold. You'll see a lot of our steel equipment comes that way. We actually sell steel oil with it that helps you extend the life of the warranty on the product that you're buying. But a two-cycle is going to need oil and gas mixture, where you've got a four-cycle that is me pouring oil in a separate chamber that, you know, needs to be checked but changed, you know, once a year. Or based on using.
The one I bought the other day, I forget, it was for, I think it was maybe my Edger, but the oil and gas came mixed, and I just poured it as a mixture. Do you recommend that? Do you like that?
That is definitely the easiest way to go. I know that still carries a MotoMix brand that, you know, it takes all the guesswork out. Do I have the right ratio of oil to gas in here? And it just prolongs the life of your equipment and just makes sure that it's running well.
I'm running out of time here. What else do you recommend we know, us homeowners, to you know, have the best gadgets and do the best job?
You know, from that standpoint, John, you know, I would always look at who's doing the job. What are they comfortable handling, and exactly what is it that they need to be able to use? You know, if I'm in Chicago and I have a bungalow and I've got a very small patch out in the very front, I'm definitely always going to want to have, you know, probably electric to take care of that. And like I said, once again, you know my wife loves to get out in the yard, but the equipment that she'll grab and use is a lot different than what I'll use, because she'll like something that's a little bit lighter that she's able to maneuver very well.
And maybe if that doesn't work out, get a new wife. Do you sell new wives at Northern Tool?
You know, this is one thing that we don't have in our current assortment, John, but thanks for asking.
Yeah, don't do that. Mark Hicks is the regional sales manager at Northern Tool. Continued success to you guys, Mark. It's nice to talk to you.
John, thank you so much for having us on today. We really appreciate y'all.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Select Chicago residents will be able to invest in the Bally's Casino. Ownership interest will be offered as part of the community agreement between the casino and City of Chicago. According to Crane's, eligibility criteria haven't been disclosed yet, but will likely include a mix of business owners, sports figures, celebrities, and everyday Chicagoans. They'll share in a 25% stake in the casino that's being developed on the Chicago riverfront, where the Chicago Tribune Freedom Center printing plant is located. The Securities and Exchange Commission has to review the offering before it's offered to investors. McDonald's is being sued by media entrepreneur Byron Allen, who says the company is not on track to meet its own commitment to spend more advertising money with black-owned media companies. Allen's companies include The Weather Channel and Justice Central and represent 90% of the black-owned advertising market in the country. Allen's lawsuit claims McDonald's commitment was a ploy to portray itself as racially sensitive and sympathetic. The company, in a statement, says it'll defend itself against the lawsuit and not be coerced. It calls Allen's lawsuit a smear campaign against McDonald's. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Let's do the business of food, then. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And here we are, the time of year when it is not a matter of if the power is going to go out, it's when and for how long. And this woman has a few words.
Being prepared is really the name of the game.
Her name's Diane, and more from her after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Diane, the power is going to go out, so...
As much as you can do ahead of time to prepare is going to make your time without electricity that much easier.
And it's prime time for the lights to go out. In Illinois, April, May, and June are the most active months for thunderstorms and tornadoes. The average U.S. electric customer lost power for nearly 8 hours in 2021. And that means trouble for your food, according to our friend
Diane Reinhold, nutrition and wellness educator for the University of Illinois Extension.
Diane says the most important tool to put in your refrigerator right now, and freezer too, is a thermometer.
Yes, that's going to help you know that your food is staying as cold as it should be.
Okay, how cold should it be?
41 degrees or below in our refrigerators.
And how long can the power be out before we need to worry?
If you keep your doors closed to your refrigerator, food is going to very likely be able to maintain the temperature for 4 hours.
And for the freezer, it's about 2 days?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, here's something you can do now and prepare for when the power goes out.
If you have some extra gel packs, throw them in the freezer. You can also take food grade containers, fill them with water, stick those in the freezer.
And when the power goes out, take them out of the freezer and put them in the fridge.
To help keep your food cold for a prolonged period of time.
But if you've been away for a while and you come back to a fridge that has been off for who knows how long?
Go ahead and discard everything. You would just work under the premise that you can get sick because it's become too warm in the refrigeration unit.
Generators are becoming more common, but only about 6% of us have those. For the rest of us?
No one wants to go through the turmoil of having a power outage and then getting sick with a foodborne related illness on top of that.
From the farm to your belly, today's National Butterscotch Brownie Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Takandra Parmar joins us now, a tech features editor at businessinsider.com. And the subject is AI, and maybe the pause that we need to hit on that. Takandra, thanks for joining us. Let's start by asking the question, what is AI these days anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I think artificial intelligence can have various different connotations to people. But right now, I think the big thing in the news is ChatGPT, or what they call in sort of scientific industry community, large-scale language models. These are the you know, sort of chatbots that you can talk to and seem to have a human-like intelligence to them that, you know, seem to be able to do basic things like writing documents for you or answering questions in sort of the most conversational forms.
Even generating art, because we've had artificial intelligence for a while, but this is almost a different application of it. It's anticipating appropriate language, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, the first, you know, sort of cultural cognizance of artificial intelligence for the average consumer was probably something like Siri or Google Assistant. But how many times did you hear from Siri or Google Assistant, oh, I'm sorry, I can't process that? You don't see that with ChatGPT in the same way. Now, that's not to say that ChatGPT and these other large-scale language models aren't flawed in some ways, but they are definitely a significant evolution in artificial intelligence.
But now there seems to be some worry about where this intelligence is taking us. Talk a little bit about that and how valid these concerns are.
Yeah, I mean, I think the worry is a good thing. So to understand this, a lot of industry people, a lot of people in the scientific community have been warning about the capabilities of this kind of artificial intelligence and perhaps the dangers that they pose. But I think a lot of that rhetoric that has then come out of it has been somewhat alarmist. I think it's a very good thing that we are warning of these kinds of things, because if we think about our history with these developments in technology, probably the one algorithm that all of us are so familiar with is the Facebook algorithm. We didn't have the same warnings about how misinformation can proliferate on something like that. Right now, we have people in the scientific community saying, hey, actually, let's put a pause on this. Let's try and regulate ourselves before we see the same kinds of wide-scale disinformation, misinformation, you know, spam being spread through something like ChatGPT. And that's a really good thing, because it's showing that, like, while in the past we've been so focused on the disruption of technology, this seems like a more mature approach to a technology that's here to stay and is, by all intents and purposes, going to revolutionize our lives.
Fair enough. I'm out of time, but just one short response from you on this, though. I think when the New York Times on Valentine's Day had one of its reporters have a conversation with ChatGPT that seemed to be if not sinister, a little creepy. I think that sort of threw up red flags for a lot of us. Like, wait a minute, what's going on here? You know what I'm talking about. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really quite funny. With all of these things, there's an uncanny valley to it. But I think what we have to remember is that this artificial intelligence doesn't actually, I think it was Kevin Roos, doesn't actually love Kevin Roos or want to have sexual engagements with Kevin Roos. I think it's, it is how you input data and what it wants, what it thinks is the best sort of string of words to give back to you.
Isn't that amazing? It's so strange that it really is that. Yeah, the ChatGPT told Roos that his wife doesn't love him anymore, which you know, I think you're right. I think we were a little alarmist out of the gate on this. But I'm also curiously cautious about where this is going to. To Kendra, you and I need to have another conversation down the road. I can tell you're dialed in on this. I hope you can join us again sometime soon.
Lovely. Sounds good.
Takendra Parmar is a features editor at Business Insider.